Section number 4410, reel number 5.
Sir John Glubb, reel 2.
An armistice was made with the French, and the Free French, that's de Gaulle's French, who were on our side, took over the administration of Syria from the Vichy French. And, of course, the Italian-German Armistice Commission and so on had to get away. So, by this means, Syria was more or less transferred to the Allied side again, although with only a small Free French army, and most of the officials in Syria came over to the Free French and remained in their jobs. By this time, the British Army had become very enthusiastic about our desert mechanized regiment and asked if we could increase it to a brigade of three regiments with a brigade headquarters and everything. And this we did as fast as we could, although, as before, we still had to buy commercial trucks on the market, and received the odd out-of-date machine gun and this kind of thing. Actually, we had already begun to make our own armored cars on Ford commercial chassis. As we had no armor plate steel, we had to use mild steel plates. And the thing to do was you put two mild steel plates together, and between the two plates you put a very thin sheet of plywood. This has the effect of when the bullet goes through the outside steel plate, it splays, and so it didn't penetrate the inside plate. But of course it made a frightfully heavy vehicle. As times proceeded, the British Army gave us out-of-date and obsolete armoured cars, which are called Marmon Harringtons, but at the beginning we had only our own homemade armoured cars. The next development which affected us was the entry of Russia into the war. And Russia was very short of armaments, and the Western Allies wished to send arms to Russia. There were only two ways. One was via Archangel, and the other was to Palestine, across Syria, across Iraq, and up through Iran to Russia. And this line from Haifa to Iran and southern Russia became a main Allied line of communications for supplying Russia. We were therefore asked to patrol and be responsible for the safety of this line of communication, which was about 800 miles, I think. And we not only patrolled it up to the Persian frontier, but we then raised some static guard companies. There weren't enough vehicles for anybody. These people were largely intended to protect the line of communication from raiding or from stealing weapons, which is a popular sport among the local people.
Who was liable to do the raiding?
Oh, any Arabs who were anxious to obtain weapons. This was not an organized enemy. So we raised, I think, 9 static infantry companies who were armed with, at first, only with rifles and had no transport. but they established posts along the staging posts all the way up the line of communications. Later, these companies also guarded the port of Haifa and various ammunition depots on the line as it passed through Iraq. So we therefore had, that was the first, the next role, guarding the lines of communication from Haifa to Russia.
But were the Arab Legion deployed along the whole of that line of communication?
Yes. Then there were various war plans. For example, it was still thought that the Germans might arrive in Syria. And there was a time during which it was thought they'd attack Turkey. But they got so bogged down in Russia, actually, they never did attack Turkey. But plans were arranged by which if the Germans arrived in Syria, we would, the Arab Legion, would hold the Syrian desert, which would be on their flank. There were also precautions taken in case Rommel took Egypt, in which case the British would have had to fall back across Sinai. And we did a number of plans and reconnaissances there. At the same time, there was a unit in Egypt called the Long Range Desert Group. And these people used to go round through the northern Sahara and attack Rommel's communications as he advanced on Egypt. And it was suggested that, after all, these people were all British, partly from Britain, partly Australians. Wouldn't it be helpful to have Arabs to do this? And so we were asked if we would do this job against Rommel. And we actually sent down an advance party under a British officer to go into what the job involved. In fact, they went into action and the officer was killed. But then the Battle of Alamein took place and the Germans pulled back over the western desert to Tunis. And so that job fell through.
Did you accompany that group yourself?
No. So that were, those were the chief jobs we did. Well, then the next plan, when the Allies took Tunis and crossed into Italy, was that we should go to Greece with the British army. But I forget why now, that also fell through. So in actual fact, much to our regret, we passed the last 2 years of the war in the Middle East. But I went down several times to GHQ Middle East, which was in Cairo. And finally they said to me, look, we've got several British divisions still in the Middle East where they're supposed to be necessary in order to keep order. It would be far better for us if you could take over responsibility for all security east of Suez, and then British troops could be used to invade Egypt, invade Europe, which is obviously more satisfactory than having British troops in Iraq and Transjordan and Palestine, and Arab troops invading Europe, which of course was obvious and was unanswerable. So we also took over duties policing Palestine. At the beginning of the war, the Jewish settlers in Palestine were very pro-ally because they were afraid that the Nazis might arrive in Palestine. But after Alamein, they became hostile. Mr. Begin arrived, amongst other people, and we had quite a problem in some places in Palestine where we were guarding large British depots, principally the port of Haifa, also Sarafand, which is a large camp and ammunition depot, and other installations in Palestine. So in effect, the last 2 years of the war, the Arab Legion was the Allied security force in the whole area from Sinai to the frontiers of Iran.
Were you under attack by Jewish groups at this time?
No. They were not seriously. The Jews at the time directed most of their efforts against the British. And their efforts were to a considerable extent inspired by the desire to get weapons from the British Army. And so they raided British camps and depots where they could. But they didn't raid any which we happened to be guarding at the time. Although it was, the atmosphere was slightly tense. There were one or two shooting incidents, but very little. As I say, because deliberately, as a matter of policy, they directed their operations against Britain.
What was the attitude of your Arab Legion men to the Second World War and its outbreak? Did they welcome the prospect of the type of action which they would be involved in once the Vichy French established themselves, or what did they make of the Second World War, if anything?
As regards the actual men, although at first, as I said, the British were slightly suspicious, the column we accompanied, afterwards they became quite the heroes of the British Army. In fact, there was rather a significant incident when a few men were taken prisoner in the attack on Palmyra and were taken off to a prisoners of war cage with a number of British prisoners of war. And the French sorted them out and said Arabs could go over there, but British prisoners would be accommodated here. And the British prisoners of war refused. They wouldn't cooperate at all unless the Arab Legion troops were allowed to live with them in the prisoners of war camp. And the French had to give way.
What was the attitude of the Arab Legion then?
So the Arab Legion were heroes to the British Army, if you see what I mean. And there was an extraordinary feeling of friendship, comradeship between the two. And the Arab Legion was aware that this was owing to their own prowess. The British welcomed them as comrades, which had a profound moral effect. I think educated classes in Transjordan, and even the Emir himself, had periods of depression when they thought perhaps Germany was going to win the war. But I don't think that ever influenced the troops, who, after all, soldiers are not very interested in high politics. They were such enthusiastic comrades of the British Army, and so proud of themselves, so to speak, for having become equal comrades of British troops. But, they never looked back or doubted, or we never had any trouble at all.
What was your own estimate of the performance of the Arab Legion in the Second World War?
Well, I don't know what field you mean. Their chief characteristic or their chief asset was their morale, which was always tremendous. Their esprit de corps was absolutely sky high. They'd take on anybody because they were so proud of themselves, and proud of themselves as being Arab soldiers. Not as being, they weren't colonial troops or anything like this. They were, they felt, a purely Arab army which had shown itself on a par with the European armies.
To what extent did the troops feel, specifically Transjordanian, as opposed to Arab, or was there no conflict between the two?
Well, in the case of the desert units, who formed a large part of the mechanized brigade, which was deliberately created to operate in the Syrian desert. In the case of the desert soldiers, they were not purely Transjordanians. The tribes of the desert are a world of their own, really, and were not touched very much by nationalism. We had some of the best men came from Saudi Arabia, some from Iraq, although the majority were probably from Transjordan, but as I say, a large proportion came from Iraq or Saudi Arabia or Kuwait. So it was more an esprit de corps, pride of being a great, a successful Arab army, rather than Transjordan versus Iraq or anything like this.
With this increase in more sophisticated equipment that you were using during the Second World War, as compared with the previous period, how did you cope with the necessity for more skilled personnel, more technical personnel?
Well, in actual fact, at any rate in those days, and the amount of equipment we had, great technical skill is not required of the soldier. An efficient weapon is one that can be shot by a man who isn't a technician. There were two fields which were more technical. One was the maintenance of vehicles. You can teach a Bedouin or anybody else to drive a truck, but maintenance requires, of course, a fitter. And the other was signals. In the case of signals, we were obliged to take educated townspeople. And curiously enough, a great majority of them turned out to be Christians. This was partly because, of course, there are a great many Christians in Jordan. This was partly because the Christians usually know European languages, learn European languages, more than Muslims do. And so, of course, our signals, working with the British Army, had to work in English. We sent, both during and after the war, a number of signalers to be trained in Britain. And they were all on the level of British Army signalers. And we used to get reports from the British Army in Britain saying how extremely efficient they were. So that was the Department of Signals was handled by townspeople and, as I say, very largely by Christians, probably because they knew English, more of them knew English. In the question of what the British Army calls Remy, that is mechanical engineering, we established a base workshop which had a British officer in command, and I think a British warrant officer, and succeeded in turning out quite adequate maintenance fitters with units, and also all our repairs. At the beginning, the British Army used to repair vehicles for us, but after a short time, we took over at our depot, and all servicing and overhauls of every kind were done by our own people. But most of these people, of course, were not tribesmen, although a few were. They were town inhabitants of Transjordan. But with those things, we made ourselves virtually self-supporting.
Could you give a sketch of your work with the Arab Legion in the post-Second World War period?
Well, of course, as soon as the... when the war ended, we were scattered all over the Middle East, where we were reckoned with the status of Allied troops. The crisis which arose as soon as we'd withdrawn from Iraq and Sinai and various other places, the crisis which loomed increasingly rapidly was, of course, Palestine. There, we still had some units. We had a company in Gaza, for example, and in Haifa. And we had units which were merely left over from the war, guarding Allied installations of one kind and another. Most of these were withdrawn in the 2 years after the war. There were still a few when the mandate came to an end. The British then said to us, would you please have all your troops out of Palestine as soon as or before the end of the mandate? Which we had to do. We had one battle with Jewish colonies because the company coming back from Gaza, the road passed by a group of Jewish settlements. And of course the whole state was in a great state of tension and nervousness and excitement. And the people of these Jewish settlements endeavoured to block the road so that our company could not get back. It was coming back to Transjordan. So quite a battle ensued, the course of which we captured the Jewish colonies.
Were you present yourself?
No. Otherwise, as I was saying, the Jews concentrated all their hostility against the British and took really no intentional direct action against us.
What happened as far as you and the Arab Legion were concerned when the State of Israel was formed in 1948?
Well, before that, I think it was in February 1948, the Transjordan government sent, or the Prime Minister of Transjordan and the Minister of Defence came to London in order to discuss with the British government what was going to happen. They took me as interpreter because the Prime Minister couldn't speak English. So we arrived in London They did some negotiation of their own about other items in the treaty between Britain and Jordan. But just before we left, the Prime Minister asked me to come with him to an interview with Mr. Ernest Bevin, and who was in Foreign Affairs, I think. When we got in there, yeah. I had to translate verbatim, word for word, you see, because I said the Prime Minister wouldn't attempt to talk English. So the Prime Minister began and said, well, in, as you know, in 2 months' time, the mandate's going to come to an end, and Palestine has been, in theory, divided into a Jewish and an Arab state by the United Nations. But we are aware, and indeed the Jewish leaders in Palestine make no secret of the fact, that as soon as the British go away, they propose to occupy the whole of Palestine, down to the River Jordan. The Arabs living in the Arab part of Palestine, or the part allotted to the Arabs by the United Nations, have no organization. They have no army. They haven't even got a shadow government ready. And they are passionately appealing to the Transjordan government to come and defend them from absorption by the Jewish state. What is the opinion of the British government regarding this? And Mr. Bevin said, we want, or we support, the action of the United Nations. We see no objection to your assisting the Arabs of Palestine in the areas allotted to them if those areas are invaded. But, for heaven's sake, don't you attempt to invade any area allotted to the United Nations, allotted by the United Nations to the Jewish state. Because if you do that, you will have us all up against the United Nations and there'll be terrible trouble. So that was the agreement reached. The British government said there's no objection to the Arab Legion helping the Arabs to defend the areas given them by the United Nations on condition they do not cross into any area given by the United Nations to the Jewish state. And that was the condition when the mandate came to an end.
So when you went back to Transjordan after this, what happened then?
Well, nothing happened until the mandate ended. The Transjordan government adopted that policy. Technically, as we were in Palestine as allies from the Second World War, the British insisted that as their allies, we must evacuate Palestine when they evacuated it. Once the mandate was over, it's nothing to do with them on that level. Except, I say that meanwhile they had told us, if we liked to go back and help the Arabs of Palestine to defend their area, they didn't see any objection in that. So we had to withdraw all Arab Legion units from Palestine before the end of the mandate. As soon as the mandate was over, some of them returned to the portion of Palestine which had been allotted to the Arabs. That is, the easterly portion, which abutted onto the River Jordan. The Arabs were also allotted Galilee in northern Palestine, but there was no means of getting there. That abutted onto Lebanon. They were also allotted Gaza and the area around it. We couldn't get there. That abutted on Sinai and Egypt. So the only part we could assist in was the eastern part from Hebron, Jerusalem, Nablus, which marched with the border of Transjordan itself. And we duly entered this area as soon as the mandate was over. The chief factors were that the Jerusalem area had been allotted by the United Nations to an international enclave, which the United Nations itself was going to administer. Well, when the mandate ended, the United Nations hadn't even sent a representative. There was a vacuum. But the Jordan government ordered us not to enter the international enclave, which had been laid down by the United Nations. However, as soon as the mandate ended, this Jerusalem area was inhabited half Arabs and half Jews. As soon as the mandate ended, the Jewish forces began to attack the Arab side of Jerusalem.